What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is David Makovsky, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of Myths, Illusions, and Peace. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's nearly Hanukkah, which begins this Tuesday night and runs for 8 great nights and days from December 20th through December 28th. As you know, all Jewish holidays begin at sundown, but none are quite so night-oriented, not even Passover, as Hanukkah. Bringing light into the season of the shortest days and longest nights of the year, Hanukkah is that rare Jewish holiday in which nearly all the observances are after dark. Sure, it's Hanukkah during the days, too, but it's the magical lighting of Chanukiyot, Hanukkah menorahs, or candelabra each night of the long festival, adding one more light each night, that is the central observance of Hanukkah. We're commanded to fulfill the great mitzvah of Pirsomet Hanes, publicizing the miracle of God's redemption at this time of year in those days long ago. And nothing does that better than lights burning brightly in the window, reminding us of the miraculous quality of God's help. Although considered a minor festival on the religious calendar in America, Hanukkah has become something quite major. In part, of course, this is because of its proximity to that other end of the American calendar year holiday that everybody likes to celebrate so thoroughly, Kwanzaa. But in part, it's also because Hanukkah is a festival that celebrates religious freedom, the right to worship God as we choose. Without the events that we commemorate at Hanukkah, the victory of the small Jewish guerrilla band led by the Maccabees over the mighty Syrian Greek army of the Seleucid Empire in the years 167 to 165 BCE, the belief in one God would have been destroyed, religious freedom eliminated from the world. There would have been no more Jews, which would mean no Christians, no Western civilization, for that matter, no Muslims either, since both Christianity and Islam are direct daughter-descendant religions of Judaism. The story of that great Maccabean revolt, catalyzed by the egotism of King Antiochus IV Epiphanes and his need to be not only obeyed but worshipped, is an underdog narrative about how a group of Jews refused to bow down to an idol or surrender their right to study Torah and educate their children in belief in God and the moral and practical principles of Judaism. They fought and died and eventually triumphed. And when they recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, they cleansed it and relit the great menorah, dedicating it anew to worship and holiness. Chanukat HaBayit, the very word Chanukah, means dedication. And so we will celebrate this week, eating anything fried in oil, remembering the oil that lit the menorah in the temple in Jerusalem, especially latkes, the fabulous fried potato pancakes. By the way, my wife Wendy and I have a fantastic sweet potato latke recipe. When we do all of this, we are celebrating something more than just the kids' festival. We are enjoying our religious freedom, which was established and protected nearly 2,200 years ago by the Maccabees. To play us in on this morning, just 3 days before Hanukkah starts, here's the latest viral hit from the Yeshiva University a cappella vocal group covering reggae star Matisyahu's Hanukkah song Miracle. It's the Maccabees.
Just living in the miracle, candles on my vehicle, 8 night, gonna shine invincible, no longer be the visible, born through the struggle, keep on moving through all this hustle, head up, head down through all of the bustle, New York City wanna flex your muscle, look so down, look so puzzled, heart around your fire through all the rubble, bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all, bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all. Yeah.
want to thank the Maccabees for their outstanding performance.
That was the Maccabees singing Matis Yahu's song Miracle for Hanukkah. You know, when did viral become a good thing? Never mind. Now I must remind you that there are only three more shopping days till Hanukkah starts on the evening of the 20th. Of course, since Hanukkah goes on for eight nights and days, you can keep on shopping right up until the eighth night. Our guest this morning is one of the pithiest and brightest of all the commentators on the Israel-American relationship and the reality of the new Middle East. Find out what David Makovsky can teach us all about that pivotal region when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. The other day when I was struggling to come up with an idea for a new Mama's commercial, I overheard a family talking about their son's high school football team. My mind raced back to 1964 in Long Island, New York, when my brother Vinny played football for the West Hempstead High School Rams. Vinny was a great player, and of course the whole Spina family went to each and every game. After the games, we'd often come home and Mom would make one of her delicious Sicilian-style pizzas. My mouth still waters when I think of the great rich-tasting tomato sauce and creamy fresh mozzarella cheese sitting on top of her warm, homemade semolina dough. It's the exact great taste we put into the pizzas we make every day at our mama's restaurants in Tucson. You know, I love thinking about football and the good old days in New York. I just wish all this reminiscing would help me come up with a good idea for a new radio commercial. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, David Makovsky. He's the Ziegler Distinguished Fellow, Director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute. He's also a lecturer in Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University's Paul Knight School of Advanced International Studies. With Dennis Ross, another former Too Jewish guest, he wrote the book in 2009, Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. He has written a number of papers. Welcome. Good morning, David.
Delighted to be with you.
So, it's been a very, very interesting year in the Middle East. More change in the last year than, oh boy, in recent memory. Tell us what we can take out of the current situation.
Look, it's, you know, if this was a baseball game, we might only be in the first inning. And so we need to be humble that and not think that we know exactly how this thing is going to turn out. But I think you're right. This is probably the most tumultuous year after the Middle East since World War One. I mean, if someone would tell you on January 1st, this is what's going to happen this year, there's going to be a fruit vendor in rural Tunisia, and he's going to set himself on fire, and that's going to bring the collapse of the Tunisian government, and Ben Ali is going to flee, and then within a few weeks later, Mubarak, who's been the biggest fixture in the Middle East in 30 years, he's going to flee as well, or he's going to be toppled as well. And then after that, there's going to be developments in Yemen and Bahrain and Libya and Syria, and the list goes on. You know, people would say, you're on drugs. There's no way. But, you know, the Middle East, truth can be stranger than fiction.
Often seems to be. You went to Syria a long time ago, I think with Warren Christopher. Tell us a little, you've been to Syria a number of times. You were maybe the first Israeli journalist to go there. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in Syria.
Well, look, I mean, I was, you know, the first journalist was then writing for an Israeli publication, which, as you point out, was many years ago. You know, what's happened is that the people have lost their fear, and they are confronting this regime. Now, Assad's father, Hafez, you know, just would launch a massacre like he did Hama in 1982, killed probably about 20,000 people, and that was it. But now we live in the era of YouTube and the flip phone and the iPhone and all sorts of things, and these pictures go out all over the world. And so he's hoping that as long that if he kills his people but stays below a certain threshold, that he will not be able, that this will not kind of, you know, be a tripwire through the whole international system, and that there would be no military intervention. And he's counting on the fact that he has a strong backer, which are the Iranians. And if Syria goes down for Iran, this is a catastrophe, because that has been their main bridge. And weapons have gone Iran, Syria, to Hezbollah. You know, the likelihood of there being another Syrian government is that they will not replicate because of this unique fact that the Alawites are an offshoot of the Shia, and the Iranian are Shia Persians, and Hezbollah is Shia Arab, that any new regime in would not be able to replicate that sort of alliance, that three-way alliance that exists today. So this would, you know, be interesting if indeed there would emerge a new regime. But Bashar is counting on the fact that he can keep killing, but at a lower rate, and not lead to massive international intervention.
Interesting concept. How do you keep the killing just below the point where it becomes a viral story? We will talk much more with Dave Makowski when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 30th to June 10th of 2012. You don't have to be a temple member to go. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to the Holy Land of Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. Hanukkah's coming up fast, just three more shopping days until the first night of Hanukkah this Tuesday, December 20th. To get you ready for the holiday of religious freedom, menorahs, latkes, and dreidels, here are the two Jewish top 10 reasons to like Hanukkah better. The top 10 reasons to like Hanukkah better. Number 10, no roof damage from reindeer. Number 9, never a silent night when you're with Jews. Number 8, if you screw up a gift, you've got 7 nights to fix it. Number 7, no barking dog's version of I have a little dreidel. Number 6, when you win a dreidel, you eat the proceeds. Number 5, you can use your fireplace all week. Number 4, naked spin the dreidel games. I didn't make that up. Number 3, Hanukkah candles make for cheaper bills than all those decorative red and green electric lights. Number 2, no awkward explanations of virgin birth to children. And the number one reason to like Hanukkah better, no Irving Berlin songs. And that's our top 10 reasons to like Hanukkah better. Irving Berlin, of course, was the great Jewish songwriter who wrote White Christmas and Easter Parade. Anyway, in the spirit of this season, we continue our pre-Hanukkah musical preview. Here are two classic Hanukkah songs from the great tenor and cantor Jan Pierce, Haneros Halalu and Al Hanisim. We light these candles for the wonders, miracles, and great acts you did for our ancestors at this time of year in those days long ago. That was the marvelous tenor and cantor Jan Pierce singing two Hanukkah songs as a preview for the coming Festival of Lights and Latkes. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbar, to the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov.
Chag Chanukah Sameach. Chanukah's coming really soon.
Chanukah's coming really soon, and I hope to see you all today at 5 o'clock at the JCC for our Chanukah, early Chanukah party with all your family and friends having fun together celebrating this unique and very special holiday.
You know, I've served congregations not only in America, but also in Israel a little bit and in Australia. And I can tell you an interesting fact, which is that Hanukkah is not a major Jewish holiday anywhere in the world except two places. Now, we always talk about it as a minor festival religiously, but in America, it's not minor at all. Everybody makes a big deal out of it, especially if they have kids. And the other place in the world where it's really important is Israel. For totally different reasons. So let's talk a little bit about how do people do Hanukkah in Israel besides eating sufganiyot?
Well, traditionally, of course, eating sufganiyot is a must. And latkes, which we don't call, by the way, latkes.
Levivot.
We call them levivot. If you go in Israel and say to people latkes, even the Yiddishke ones won't understand you, maybe except for the ultra-Orthodox at Mea Shearim. But other places, people don't know what latkes are, but they know levivot. And of course, part of the idea is to make special levivot, not only with potatoes, sometimes with other stuff in
it. Zucchini, you know, and sweet potatoes, yeah, and lots of different things.
I'm coming hungry. Okay. And play with dridles and all that kind. And of course, we lit the candles. It's a very family holiday. You lit the candles every day with your family. You put the Chanukiah near the window usually so people can see it.
And actually, you know, when I lived in Jerusalem, the people had outdoor glass display boxes built into their walls to put the Hanukkah menorah out there so everybody could see it. And they used oil lamps.
Right. And it's a very nice experience where you go to some neighborhoods where there are a lot of apartments.
Yeah, it's really
cool. You can see the whole house with Chanukiyot all across. Another element very strong in Hanukkah in Israel, and I don't know why, but it's kind of the celebration of all the festival and kids shows. There are a lot of shows like the Pestigal and Festival, a lot of festivals of all types of songs, children choirs, performers, very big Broadway-style shows that you can go and, well, you pay a lot of money. You get tickets.
Of course, of
And then you celebrate there with a lot of songs and dancing and stuff like that. A lot of fun. That's also very traditional for Hanukkah. And you know, Hanukkah is, as we said last week, it's very Zionist. So in many ways, it celebrates, you know, Israel. It celebrates being Israel, being a free people in our land. And I think people are happy with it. It's very different than the version of Hanukkah that people are celebrating around here. Because in many ways, well, maybe I'm wrong on it, but it appears that in the U.S., and you can tell me more about that, the Hanukkah is more kind of the Jewish version for that other holiday that people celebrate around that time.
Yeah, Kwanzaa, I think it's called, right? I think that's true. I think there's a commercial quality to the Hanukkah celebrations here. Any holiday for which you can buy not only Hanukkiyot and Sevivonim, you know, and dreidels, but you can get rugs, you can get Hanukkah bunting, you can get Hanukkah placemats, tablecloths. I'm sure you can get Hanukkah ear warmers now, socks. This is America. We find a way to merchandise everything.
Well, then have a happy Hanukkah, eat a sufganiya, and have it sweet.
Absolutely. Thanks, Guy. Chag Hanukkah Sameach.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, best place downtown to get a meal any time of day.
We just celebrated our first year anniversary.
Mazel
tov. Thank you. Lunch, dinner, happy hour starts at 4 every day. We have late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights with live music. It really is. We are busy from the time we open the doors. It's so much fun to be downtown.
It's a great thing to go there and then go on and see a show, isn't it?
Yeah. Pre-performance, people are really get busy then. It's fantastic. Make your reservations. Come in and eat before the theater or the symphony or the opera. Then come back afterwards and have some dessert.
What's the best way to make reservation for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
Just get on the phone and give us a call, 623-7700, or go to our website, downtownkitchen.com.
You can also get there through the Janos website, I think, janos.com.
We make it easy to find us.
Thanks, Janos. See you for the holidays, Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the French politician, and some of his family connections. Let's continue that theme a little bit. He's been mentioned as a possible head for the World Bank, a possible head for the Israeli financial system, now that he's on the outs in France after this big political scandal. Let's continue on him.
Well, he was viewed as the most likely candidate to defeat Sarkozy in the next presidentials. He would be the major candidate of the left, and Sarkozy would be the major candidate of the right.
Sarkozy, of course, also has some Jewish antecedents, although he himself's not Jewish.
Right. Although, you know, the degree to which somebody's Jewish isn't really always relevant, in my view. But never mind that. This program is, after all, called
Too Jewish. Jewish.
Right. So, Dominique, when I first got to know him, was sort of a young future leader of the Socialist Party. This was probably just over 20 years ago. And like many French politicians, he held two elective offices. One was the mayor of town X. In his case, it was Sarcelles, which is a working class suburb of Paris. And he was a parliamentarian from a district slightly larger than the town of which he was the mayor. So a lot of parliamentarians are called deputy mayors, meaning not that they're the assistant mayor, but that they're a deputy sitting in the Chamber of Deputies, which is the French version of the House of Representatives, and they're a mayor. And they get a hyphenated title, and they get two salaries. both of which are fairly small. So in campaigning for re-election, you campaign for both at once, the mayor and the seat in parliament. And I took the train out to this working class suburb, which was basically a bunch of housing projects with foreign immigrants, many of whom didn't speak much French, and where there was high unemployment. So a lot of guys sitting around outside playing shesh-besh or smoking or whatever. But we went door to door and we knocked on doors. And in one case, I'll never forget this story. A timid lady pulled open the door, which had a chain, and she was clearly from somewhere in North Africa. And she said, "Oui, monsieur, je peux vous aider? Can I help you?" And he explained that he was running for office and would like to meet her and explain why she should vote for him. And I said, "Is it stuffed peppers you're cooking?" And there was this big smile, and she said, "Come in, I'll serve you." I said, "No, actually, thank you very much. We don't have time to eat, but it smells delicious." And she said, "How could you tell from outside what I was cooking?" And I said, "Well, you know, I have a good Jewish nose." And they all got a huge laugh. And Dominique's comment after this exchange was, "Maybe you should consider politics instead of diplomacy. You're very talented at it." So it was like a mutual compliment. And then, of course, years later, he was minister for foreign trade or something. He'd risen through the ranks, and he was a cabinet member. Came to Washington. The ambassador hosted a soiree for him, and he insisted that I be invited. And I was working in the State Department in some completely other capacity that had nothing to do with France or the French embassy. Nobody in the French embassy knew me except a young guy who had been at the National School of Administration in Paris with me, and he was their source on me. So when I walked in and got a big hug and was called by the familiar form of "you," all kinds of eyebrows went up. The ambassador, like, "Who is this guy?" And it was pretty funny. But, I mean, I knew the guy fairly well and have great admiration for his intellect and his person. He's very charming.
We will talk more next week, Tom. A very interesting story, interesting guy. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe goes to the cemetery to visit his mother's grave. He hears loud crying coming from another part of the graveyard and goes over to investigate. A woman stands at a grave, sobbing and weeping uncontrollably. "Oi, Yoisi, it's been 4 years since you left me, but I still miss you so much." So Moshe asks her, "Who are you mourning?" "My husband," she replies. "I miss him so much." Moshe is very puzzled. He says to her, "Your husband? But it says on this headstone, 'In memory of Frida Goldberg.'" "Oh, yes," she says. "He always put everything in my name." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. In this week's Torah portion of Miketz, we're in the midst of the fabulous story of Joseph, now shorn of his technicolor dream coat and locked away in an Egyptian prison.
"I wore my coat with golden lining, high color shining, wonderful and new. And in the east, the dawn
Dreams play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis and not for the first time in this Joseph story. In Miketz, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. 7 fat cows emerge from the Nile River and are eaten by 7 skinny cows. Then 7 fat ears of grain are devoured by 7 lean ears of grain. The Pharaoh wakes up puzzled and disturbed. What does it all mean? None of the Egyptian king's brilliant advisors and counselors can help him. In desperation, he turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once helped his chief wine steward, that is his bartender, when he was in jail with him. It is Joseph, the Hebrew slave, long forgotten. Joseph is dragged from prison, cleaned up, brought to the Pharaoh, perhaps the most powerful man in the world.
Joseph hears Pharaoh's dreams and correctly interprets them, prophesying 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God for being his only source of insight, Joseph helps the Pharaoh save Egypt, and things go well both for him and Egypt. He rises to great prominence, second in command of the whole country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied, while his own people are saved from destruction. The story doesn't end there, of course. Joseph marries, has two children, but oddly, his great success, power, and fame throughout Egypt and his new family aren't quite enough for him. Joseph misses his father, left behind in Canaan. He pines for his younger brother Benjamin, the only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. He never expects to see his father and full brother again. Joseph is, in a word, a little bit depressed. But then, in a plot twist worthy of our finest novelists, his brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are completely in his power. What an amazing opportunity for revenge. And in this week's Torah portion of Miketz, Joseph takes advantage of that. He teases and torments his brothers, fully aware of their identity. They, however, are completely ignorant of his. It's a game of cat and mouse, and Joseph seems to relish manipulating, teasing, emotionally torturing his brothers. What will happen? As the Torah portion of Miketz concludes, we're left wondering which way it will all go. Next week, of course, we'll get the answer, but this week the issue is clearly delineated. How exactly will an assimilated Jew respond to pressure to continue to hide his identity? Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation, to give up their Judaism, so too Joseph struggled with hiding his identity or admitting it in public. No matter how prominent we may become, that pressure to assimilate, even to hide our Judaism, can be overwhelming. In a season in which the majority culture can overwhelm us with its songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews today sometimes struggle to assert our pride in our own Jewish identities. May we learn from the lessons of Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity must be asserted proudly and with commitment, even in the darkest of days. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, David Makovsky, will explain the entire Middle East to us succinctly and pungently. You don't want to miss it. We'll be back in a moment on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per
for individuals a tax credit and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Israel, a case of plagiarism in the Jewish literary world has been decided dramatically. After 4 years of courtroom work, the Jerusalem District Court upheld writer Sarah Shapiro's claim of plagiarism against best-selling author Naomi Regan. The court ruled that Regan knowingly copied from Shapiro's work in producing her novel, Sota. Shapiro submitted her claim against the best-selling Regan back in 2007. Both writers are originally from America's Orthodox Jewish community. Shapiro now lives in Jerusalem and writes in English. Back in 1990, she sought Naomi Regan's opinion about her debut novel. The two met. Subsequently, Shapiro claimed she was surprised to find entire sections from her book, Growing with My Children, in Regan's top-selling book, Sota. In a 92-page opinion, Judge Joseph Shapiro fully upheld Shapiro's claim against Regan. The court determined the plagiarism was tantamount to a premeditated act, saying that Regan acted knowingly and copied work created by the plaintiff. The court relied on testimony furnished, ironically, by Naomi Regan herself. The court noted she had testified that work written by the plaintiff served as raw materials for her, that her method of writing is based on drawing from a well and imagination in ways that include the works of others, including those rendered by the plaintiff. That's sometimes called plagiarism. Damages have yet to be determined. An Orthodox rabbi who was barred from serving as an army chaplain because he refused to shave his Chabad beard has won his legal fight against the military and was finally sworn in last week. Rabbi Menachem Stern of Brooklyn was officially admitted to the U.S. Army chaplaincy in a ceremony at the Shul Jewish Community Center in Surfside, Florida. Stern is a member of Chabad Lubavitch. Those rabbis are prohibited from shaving their beards. "I felt the chaplaincy was my calling," Stern said. The rabbi saw an ad in late 2008 for military chaplains and attended a recruiter's presentation. After meeting with his wife, he decided to apply in January of 2009, making clear in his application he had to keep his beard. "Although we adapted to the modern world, we still maintain old world values," he wrote. "By not trimming my beard, I represent the unadulterated view of the Holy Torah, the way we believe a person should live." Of course, some, but not all, Orthodox Jews don't shave, believing the passage in Leviticus, "Do not clip your hair at the temples or trim the edges of your beard," specifically outlaws it. According to the lawsuit he'd later file, Stern was alerted by both email and letter that he had been accepted as a U.S. Army chaplain. When he first got word, he jumped in the air, thrilled at the news. A day after the latter mailing, though, the Army rescinded the offer, citing its own prohibition on beards. "To find out the following day that it was an error was a very big letdown," said Rabbi Stern. Stern has ministered in prisons, hospitals, and nursing homes, taught at a Hebrew school, volunteered as an EMT, directed children's summer camps, but he felt the military chaplaincy most fit his duty to make the world a better place with acts of goodness and kindness. Took two New York senators, Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, and Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut to write to the Army on Stern's behalf. The Aleph Institute in Surfside, Florida, also took on Stern's case, filing a federal lawsuit in Washington about a year ago. Aleph works on behalf of the Department of Defense in vetting rabbis to serve as military chaplains. Finally, there was a settlement on November 22nd, allowing Stern to serve. "This is just the second time ever and the first time in more than 30 years that a bearded Jewish rabbi has been granted an exemption to serve as a military chaplain. Army regulations require men to be clean-shaven except for neatly trimmed mustaches as part of an elaborate list of grooming standards for the Army that dictate everything from fingernail length to wigs." Anyway, Stern's lawsuit noted that aside from this rabbi in the 70s, a handful of Sikh and Muslim chaplains have been granted exemptions from the beard ban recently, and members of special forces are routinely granted exemptions,
purportedly for missions in the Arab world, where a beard can allow an American soldier to blend in. Rabbi Sanford Drezin, a retired army chaplain and director of Aleph's military programs, administered the oath to Rabbi Stern. While the settlement with the army does not change the rule on facial hair, he hopes it will help ease the exemption process for future rabbis. If the army can live with the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think it can live with a few bearded rabbis, said Chaplain Drezin, who does not wear a beard.
You gotta fight for your right to party!
And the Beastie Boys are going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The pioneering hip-hop group, made up of Mike D, that's Michael Diamond, MCA, that's Adam Yauch, and Ad Rock, which is Adam Horowitz, these are all Jewish guys from Brooklyn, will join a Hall of Fame class of 2012 that includes the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Guns N' Roses. The Beastie Boys, creator of hits such as Fight for Your Right to Party, No Sleep Till Brooklyn, and Sabotage, have released 12 albums. They have sold more than 40 million copies worldwide. Wow. They were a cutting-edge hip-hop group, the first white guys to make it big in the new sound. Rolling Stone magazine memorably headlined its big article on their breakout album, License to Ill, Three Idiots Create a Masterpiece. The Beastie Boys induction ceremony will be held in April at the Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Mazel tov. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, David Makovsky. He's a Ziegler Distinguished Fellow, Director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute. He's also a lecturer in Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins at the NHTSA School of Advanced International Studies. He is the co-author with Dennis Ross of the book about 2 years ago, Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East, and many, many other articles and publications. David, it's a great question. You know, some of the change in the Middle East has been so shocking, as you noted. We noted earlier the fall of Mubarak, the collapse of Tunisia, Libya. Some of those regimes were, at least ostensibly, very favorable to the United States, were, if not exactly client states, had reasonable relationships, and even had some kinds of peace relationships with Israel. With Syria, the opposite is true. How does the United States react to this changing climate without really knowing where it's all going?
Well, it's hard. I mean, the U.S. on one hand is, you know, is buoyed by the fact that the calls of the people at the Tahrir Square in Egypt and other places is they want democracy and they want economic empowerment. This is certainly a slap in the face to Al-Qaeda. I was glad that bin Laden was alive to see it for his last few months. Was that before he was killed? Was that that his prediction that the people would all go for the Islamists and in a violent way did not turn out? This is about a desire for freedom and for economic opportunity, and that's a good thing. And you know, the democracies, the literature says, did not fight other democracies. So over the long term, this is probably a good development for peace. But in the short to intermediate term, and we just don't know how long that will be, this will be rockier. The same literature that says the process of democratization, getting from A to B, and we don't know if this is 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, because the institutional infrastructure often isn't there, that the process of getting there, it could be more turbulent, more destabilizing. So while in the long term people are hopeful, in the short term, you have to also be watchful that we don't know how long this process of getting from A to B is. Also, in the Middle East, we found out that democracy is really not linear, that there are people there who are dedicated to hijacking it. Let's just give a couple examples. In 1979, it was the Communist Party, the Tudeh Party, along with the Islamists that joined hands to overthrow the Shah. But certainly shortly after he was overthrown, the Islamists turned on the secularists and purged them. And we've been dealing with a very nefarious Iranian regime for the last 30 years. Or in Lebanon, 2005, you had a pro-democracy movement called the March 14th Movement. But Hezbollah insisted on keeping its weapons. And in 2008, they went into the hills called the Shuf Mountains, where a guy named Walid Jumblat, the head of the Druze, lives. He was a key pillar of the Lebanese pro-Western coalition. He got scared because Hezbollah started shooting at his house, and he pulled out. And then the whole Lebanese government fell. So we should be aware that in these Arab countries that these things are not linear. And we're all hopeful, but we know that there are people who are dedicated to hijacking democracy. And in the short to intermediate term, you got to kind of put the tray tables in the upright position and fasten your seatbelts, because it could be a very bumpy ride.
One of the really challenging things for the United States is finding ways to involve itself in the Middle East. It's, you know, such a huge influence. But what, who does the United States support? How, in this early stage of all of this change, how does the United States government find its way?
It's hard. I mean, you know, it's like, for example, in Egypt, you know, you have Muslim Brotherhood who talk a good game, and yet are they committed really to the same American principles of freedom and economic opportunity? You know, I think there's some major questions here. And so while the U.S. is so gratified that the slogans have not about been death to America or death to Israel or anything like that, but we don't know if the people that could be empowered, let's say in the Egyptian elections, will be some of the most, you know, I would say, hardline forces in Egyptian society. Now, these people are not looking to take over immediately, per se, because the economy in Egypt is terrible. I mean, I think they've lost, according to the World Bank, over half of their world currency reserves just this year. But, you know, they clearly have an agenda, and it might be a longer-term agenda. So we should be aligned, I think, with those people who seek similar things as we do, which is, you know, freedom, economic opportunity, you know, peace, women's rights, pluralism, a more tolerant society. And we'll know those forces when we see them. But I'm worried that the Brotherhood might emerge as the strongest bloc after the Egyptian elections, even if they don't have over 50%, but they could be the largest bloc.
Right. The it seems to me that in recent days, the Hamas and Fatah are, as always, struggling for the hearts and minds of the Palestinians. So when Fatah and goes to the UN and the Palestinians declare a state, then Hamas makes a deal with Israel to release Gilad Shalit. Am I wrong to see it in that those terms?
Look, there's no doubt that what we saw with the Shalit deal was a perfect storm, that everybody's interests kind of lined up for a certain moment in time. Hamas is trying to, distance itself from Syria for the reasons we discussed, that Syria is killing their own people. That means pious Muslims, too, and that's hard for them. And they also know the Iranian thing is controversial. It gets them in trouble with the Saudis and some others. So they are... And they see that things going their way in Egypt and maybe in Jordan even. So they are trying to realign. If they could, they wanted to give a victory to the Egyptian mediators, and they did. So that worked out for them. For the Israeli side, the fear was the window was closing in Egypt. There could be new elections where the Brotherhood does well and the Egyptian mediation either collapses or the price gets higher. So there was a feeling, you know, you either cut the deal now or you might not ever get it. And people are haunted there by the whole Rana Rod business and all that meant, where people thought they'd get a better bargain later, and in the end the guy was dead. So, you know, that was a factor. I also think, you know, you're right in what you were saying, that that the whole business about Abbas suggested that Israel was less invested in him in a certain way, and therefore that also facilitated the move. The United States is very, very, you know, keenly focused on what does, if you help Hamas, it hurts Abbas, like a seesaw competition. But the U.S. was also upset with his move to the U.N. So it just kind of all aligned for a given moment that the U.S. was doing that. I mean, that Israel was doing what it wanted to do, because it feared that things would get worse. There might be political considerations as well, that, you know, Netanyahu saw, you know, that there were all these social protest movements in Israel, and people saw nothing's moving on peace. Well, here at least he could demonstrate some movement. So it just, it all lined up for the leaders in a certain way. Whether it's a good thing or not is a separate discussion.
Do you think that there's a course that Israel should be taking in all of this that they're not taking right now?
Well, I'm a bit just concerned that we're these clocks are ticking, and it's not just against Israel, but for people who want peace. I mean, for the Israeli side, you've got like five clocks that are ticking. You've got the demographic clock. Israel wants to be a Jewish state. If they don't divide the land over there, they risk being a minority at a certain point. Now, that means if you include
the West Bank.
West Bank and Gaza. So there is an issue. Then there's other issues. There's the issue of radicalization, that if you don't do a deal with Abbas and Fayyad, are they discredited? And the alternative is not the Hadassah women of Brooklyn, but it's Hamas. And then the third element is precision-guided technology that, frankly, Israel has made some, working with the U.S., has got some impressive things to show, what's called Iron Dome. But you can't stop, this stuff, and it's going to be more accurate despite all your efforts. And the third and the fourth is the more the Palestinians go to nonviolence, the more it will be easier for them to try to galvanize a really horrific sort of contrast, and try to boycott Israel economically and through the way this has been done against other countries in the past. We've already seen little signs of this on campus, called the boycott and divestment movement, although that's still pretty small. But I worry that this can grow, and especially if they go for nonviolence. And then finally, the old Arab Spring that we were talking about at the start, I'm worried that the Arab Spring will, what we were discussing about how it could empower the most hardline people who gained political energy off the stalemate and empower them. Look at Erdogan in Turkey. Look how he's exploited this issue for domestic political purposes inside Turkey, and look how he's trying to exploit this issue to assert a regional primacy at a time that, the Arab leaders are like 88 years old. Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, for example, and Mubarak's been in a cage in a courtroom. I mean, so these people exploit the vacuum, and that's a big concern.
I want to thank David McCuskey for a terrific visit here on Two Jewish, a highly insightful survey of the Middle East, and even some prophetic statements about how we might proceed in the future. Thank you so much, David.
I'm delighted to help you anytime.
People can find his book, Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East, and I think it's still relevant with all the changes, don't you?
I think so.
Thanks, David. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be celebrity chef Jeff Nathan, who has a TV show and some of the best kosher restaurants in the world. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website. And please, friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview for the Festival of Lights, which begins Tuesday night. It's a little calypso version of I Have a Little Dreidel. My friends, may you be blessed with a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy holiday of Hanukkah, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of light and peace.
Of grace.